Matthew chapter 9, reading from verse 35. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered, like sheep having no shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Now I propose that we cover a series of talks on missions. The reason being that I've given this series of talks something like 5 or 6 times over the years at various places, but I don't remember having covered it as a series, although bits and pieces of the material have been covered along the way, but I don't remember doing it as a whole series in the church. And since currently I'm putting all this down in writing, I thought I will do it starting tonight. We have just finished a series on Deuteronomy, and before we come back to a book of the Bible, I thought it would be good to have a topical study like this. So we tonight come to consider missions. And if we were to follow the chapters of the book that is taking shape currently, and God willing, by early next year, we hope it will see the light of day. If we were to cover according to all the contents of each chapter, we will need something like 2 sessions at least for each chapter. So that would be covering the book more thoroughly. But the struggle of the preacher is always between having more depth and losing out on breath, or having more breath and then losing out on depth. So we will try not to lose out too much on the depth, but we would like to have a little bit more breath by just covering it in a few chapters or a few sessions. And in that way, we have an overall view of the thing. Then when the book comes out later, God willing, you can read through more thoroughly. So at least you have an idea of what the book is all about beforehand. So today we start with an introduction to missions. And we begin by noting that a typical book on church history will divide the history that is being studied into a number of periods. So typically the periods would be as follows. The first period will be from the time of Christ to Constantine, that is AD 31 to 33, or to the year 300, so roughly, right? Then the second period would be from Constantine to Charlemagne. Charlemagne is around about 800, not precisely, but from 300 AD to 800 AD. And why Constantine, why Charlemagne? Before we continue, the reason is because Constantine was the emperor who professed to become a Christian, whereas the earlier Roman emperors were all haters of the church and the Christians and persecuted the church severely, and a number of them more severe than others. For example, Domitian was one of those who severely persecuted the church, and Nero was one of those who really persecuted the church very severely. So some less severely, others very severely throughout the Roman Empire, and until we come to Constantine. And then Constantine claimed that he saw a vision of the cross in the sky, and along the way he won the battle over his rival, and he claimed that the Christian God helped him, and so he professed change. So he called upon the Christian bishop in the city to kind of give him lessons of the Christian faith. So we question whether that was real conversion. So, but it gave peace to the Christians throughout the Roman Empire. It has its negative side in that it causes Christianity no more to be persecuted, and therefore it became soft, and everyone wanted to be known as a Christian, so they rushed to church, and so the church was filled with people who were not truly converted. So that was the problem. Yeah. Then the second period is from Constantine to Charlemagne. Charlemagne was the man who stopped the Turks from entering Europe, see, because the Muslims rose up and then fought and conquered many places. So the Christian places throughout the Mediterranean were all conquered by the Muslims. So remember, Turkey was a Roman province of Asia. Many churches were there, but the Muslims took over. Then towards the south, you see, in Egypt, yeah, they conquered. Yeah. So all around the Mediterranean, then they began to move west, and they went up to Spain. And then finally, they were stopped by this so-called Christian emperor, Charlemagne. Then from the third period, will be from Charlemagne to Martin Luther. That period has been called the Dark Ages or the Medieval Age, in which a lot of superstition was being propagated by the Roman Catholic Church, and people were selling indulgences or certificates to heaven. So it caused a lot of upset to those who were spiritual minded. So people like John Wycliffe arose to preach the gospel and send out his people everywhere to preach. They are known as the Lollards. And then after that, in Europe, there were the followers of John Huss in what is today's Czechoslovakia. And then so what happened is that John Huss was burned at the stake, and John Huss' writings in turn affected Martin Luther. Martin Luther was converted. Martin Luther then preached the gospel, and Martin Luther was used by God to start off the Reformation. So the Reformation started in 1517 and affected Europe. The churches were turned upside down, and the Roman Catholic Church tried to oppose it, but the Protestant faith continued to grow. So the Bible was recovered, the gospel was recovered, lives were changed. So it was a Reformation. That means men engaged in change in the church. So you reformed the church, the Reformation, but at the same time it was a revival in that God by His Spirit was changing lives. So the Reformation was both the work of men and the work of God, and God was changing men to do things that in the past was unthought of. So the Reformation spread to the British Isles, affecting the nation of Britain and also at the same time the Netherlands, which was nearby. So the Reformation was like mirrored between Britain and Netherlands. They were in communication with one another, and they interacted with one another, and they were vibrant Christians. So that brings us up to the year 1700. Then the next period of church history would be the period of revivals and missions, 1700 to 1900. So in around about 1735, George Whitefield began to preach. Then John Wesley and Charles Wesley were converted. They also began to preach, and others were also preaching, and revival took place. See? So the churches, dying churches were revived. See? Then those churches that have gone astray to hyper-Calvinism were revived. See? Some still oppose the revival, thinking that it was a spurious work of God, but other particular Baptists believe that it was a true work of God. They joined in the preaching, and there was revival everywhere. Then they traveled to America, and in America there was revival there as well. Jonathan Edwards and others were preaching. See, so revival on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. Yeah. So what happened is that the particular Baptists towards the year 1760 something, yeah, they began to agitate for missions, and then William Carey was one of those who agitated for it. 18 something, then what happened is that they decided to form a missionary society to send missionaries out. But who are the missionaries? Carey offered himself. He would go first. So he went. So the missionary society supported him, and he was joined by two other friends later. And then they formed a mission team in Serampo, Calcutta area, and then they were greatly used by God, and then the mission spread. Then other missionary bodies were formed. So the Anglicans also formed their missionary society based in London to send out missionaries. And then in America, missionary societies were formed, and Adoniram Judson was sent out by the Congregationalists. And along the way, in his travel to India, he studied about baptism and he became convinced of the Baptist position. So he met with William Carey, and then after consulting with William Carey, he went to Burma and he became the missionary in Burma until he died. Okay. So that was a period of tremendous missionary activities. Yeah? Then we come to the next period, the modern period, 1900 to 2000. Yeah? And the history of this period is still being written. And who writes will show his slant. Huh? If you are from a charismatic background, this period of history will, because it's still not quite settled, whereas the older periods, everyone have read and studied and argued, and along the way, it's quite agreed what happened from that point, from the general point of view. But the modern period is still fluid. It's written, books are produced, lectures are given in colleges and so on, but the slant depends on which denomination, which writer writes and so on. So why is it called the modern period? It's the period when there's scientific discovery following the Enlightenment in Europe, and then scientific discovery, the steam engine was found, and then the ships began to travel, trading took place, you see. And people began to emphasize on science, the scientific approach. See? You must be able to test things before you can believe in it. So Christians were leading the way, Isaac Newton and others making discovery in physics and in medicine and in chemistry, in various other areas, and astrology and so on as well. Okay. By the time we come to this century, we enter into what is called postmodernism, the postmodern period. And again, this is ongoing, is noticeable. Observers and writers, philosophers, they are able to observe this change. And when you have a greater exposure to the things that's happening around the world, you see, yes, something is happening that's quite different from the past. In the past, there's emphasis on solid evidence, the ability to touch and see, to prove. See, so that's the scientific approach. So it affected the Bible in that the Bible has to be studied scientifically, using scientific method in linguistics to examine which portion is added on later and which portion were originally written in the time of Christ or during the apostles. They use so-called form criticism, redaction criticism, textual criticism. Some of them were good, but some were just really liberal approaches intended to find fault with the Bible. See, so that's the modern period. See? So to know our present period and to be useful in missions in our present postmodern period, we really have to know more about the modern period. See? So this is where we have to see it from our perspective, what happened at that time, and propose what should be done. And of course, our emphasis should be from the Bible. But how does the Bible affect the situation in the world? We must see the situation in the world so that we know how the Bible may be brought to affect the situation. So how can you straight away say Bible and then in this postmodern period, but you don't know what has been happening and developing to this present situation? So let us try to understand the modern period leading to the postmodern period we are in now. See? So what is a postmodern period? Postmodern period, people are returning to relativism. You say, oh, that's your view, but you must allow people to have their view. So relative. In the past, it was in different cultures, different communities, but it was suppressed because of the modern period. The people want scientific method, proof, and objective approach to things. See? But now we are entering the period where people are so subjective and relative, you see, based on feelings, subjective. Relative is you have your own view, we have ours. So subjective means it's very much on feelings. And then also the idea that, you know, we must be politically correct. Be careful what you say, you know. Don't say God is he. Then if you say he, then what the ladies feel upset, you know. God is for everyone, why you call him he? So they have difficulty, you know, how to say she is wrong. So because of wanting to be politically correct, problems like this arise. then gender equality becomes pushed to the limit. So I call it ultra gender equality. The Christian faith gives a true gender equality, recognizing that we are equal before God, but we have different roles. So the Bible's teaching is like that. The church might take it to the left or to the right, but the fault lies with the people. It's not with the Bible. We believe the Bible's teaching is right. But today's world, because of postmodernism, they press gender equality to the limit. So they want everyone to be equal. And in the place of work, they will say, you know, how many percent of the workers are ladies? No, don't have men only. No, this is wrong. You know, it's not acceptable. So in today's world, these are not acceptable. Then how many minorities are in your college? You say, so you must have certain percentage representation, and so on. So people become very sensitive about all this. So this is postmodernism. Then another thing is, you see, the opinion of the masses must be listened to. You see, the customer is always right. Now, if anybody complain, just give in and say, yes, thank you for telling me, we'll correct things. You know, you don't say, we are right, you know, you don't like, you leave it. No, you see. So it affects the church. The church also have seeker-sensitive approach, not to offend people with their words, you see, and see what people want, and then we adjust the church to what they want. You see, then the church is no more called a church. It might be called something, so to attract people. So we have to be careful. We are in the postmodern period. We want to continue with the work of missions. We want to propose an approach that is biblical. Yeah, we believe it is biblical. We want to argue it out that the Bible has the answer for missions, even in the postmodern era. But in this introduction, we look at the previous period, the modern period where modernism was in the churches. See? So the modernists or liberals, they say we mustn't believe in the resurrection of Christ, you know, that is cannot be proven. The virgin birth, that cannot be proven, that's only myth. See, the creation of the universe in 6 days, that's only myth. It's meant to teach lessons only. So we must depend on scientific approach. So evolution is the thing to believe in. So they want to bring all this into the church. See? So that was the scientific period, the modernist period, the liberal period. So how did it interact? How did it affect the world at that time? What was it like? What was the world like in which modernism, theological liberalism, how did it thrive? How did it impact the world? You see, how did it intersect with the world? So I just want to give a rough overview. So modernism and missions, we consider first in the East and then in the West. Then we come to consider more from the biblical perspective. So in the East, the period 1900 to 1930, throughout the world actually, was a tumultuous period, you see. So in the East, we have Dr. Sun Yat-sen, who agitated against the decadent Qing or Manchu dynasty. Remember, it was really corrupt from within. And the Westerners came and spread opium, and the Chinese got weakened, and the money was drained out of the country. And then each nation went there to carve out for themselves a place. Say, Hong Kong went to the British, Macau went to the Portuguese, and then the Shantung went to the Germans, and then the Americans went to Shanghai, and French as well went to Shanghai. Each have their so-called area known as concessions. You see, that was the time. You see? Then during that time, Dr. Sun Yat-sen was very upset with the situation and wanted to, he knew that we have to have a new form of government. He studied in the West. He had been exposed to democracy, and although it was not perfect, he knew very well it wasn't perfect, but he nevertheless knew that China had to change. We have been keeping close to ourselves, Hatsongkuo, the center of the universe. So we keep thinking too highly of ourselves, we forget that we have decayed from within. So here came this Chinaman, a wholehearted, true-blooded Chinaman who is loyal to his country, loved his country, and wanted to see change. So how do we go about it? One man against the whole country. So he had friends all around the Hua Chiao, the overseas Chinese. He formed cells everywhere. He has headquarters in Tokyo, Chongqing, so we have Beijing, Nanjing. But where is Chongqing? The east city is actually Tokyo, because in the early period, you know, the whole area had Chinese influence during the Tang Dynasty, and also a little in the Ming Dynasty. But during the Tang Dynasty, Chinese culture was adopted by everyone. People like China so much. Without you forcing them, they come to China to study, to learn the language. They adopted the written script. They wear Chinese dress. There was a lot of interaction. They willingly bring tribute. They say, you know, we come to wish you a happy birthday and bring a lot of gifts from overseas. You see, that was the period when Chinese culture was everywhere. That's why not only the written script is used by different countries, but the calendar was used and the dress was used, eating with chopsticks and various things. Well, it was just one big general area that was under Chinese influence, you see. But the point is that it has decayed so much. So it took a man like Sun Yat-sen to realize we can't continue like this. Don't bluff ourselves, don't kid ourselves. We something has to be done. So you have to know his thinking and know a bit of his writings to realize that this is really a far-sighted man and who has deep thoughts. See, and how to mobilize people to bring about change. Wow, this is not easy, you know. So it requires a man of tremendous insight, foresight, see, perseverance, and a man of great wisdom, see, a man of great ability to see that you have to have particular action and general action. You have to have a big view and a small view. You have to relate the two. You focus too much on the particular, you lose out on the general. You focus on the big picture, you don't get anywhere because the particular is not done. It takes a leader, a true leader, to be able to see things like this and assess things. So he has kept the headquarters also in Singapore, and then when his own people turned against him, he decided, I have no point fighting it out between ourselves. He moved it to Penang. So Penang up to today, they have preserved his house where he uses the headquarters there. Yeah. So this man managed to bring about and have China declared as the people's, declared as the Republic of China on 1st January 1912. And that paved the way for change. But remember, he had to, as it were, do battle on many fronts. The Westerners were there everywhere. Then the Japan aligned with Germany and Italy and began to attack Manchuria, you see. And then they give the excuse, find an excuse to cross over Manchuria and, you see, go to cat and mouse game, and finally they play a trick and then manage to cross the bridge and then go in, you know, to attack Beijing, you know. And well, so the war really caused the overseas Chinese to be agitated as well, and they sent money to support the fight against the Japanese. And sad to say, the Chinese have different ideologies. So Mao Zedong was influenced by Stalin and Lenin and all those thoughts, but he wanted a Chinese version of it, so he came up with his Maoism, see? And he opposed this Chiang Kai-shek, who was a nationalist, who virtually took over from Sun Yat-sen. See? So what happened is Mao won the war. Chiang Kai-shek had to flee to Taiwan. Yeah? So Mao Zedong declared the People's Republic of China on 1st October 1949. So both to the communists as well as the Chiang Kai-shek's party in Taiwan, both acknowledged Sun Yat-sen as the founder of modern China. Yeah. And the thing to note is that from the Christian point of view, actually many people don't realize that there's Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek were actually professing Christians. And if today, if you go to Taiwan, there is a chapel in the garden there where Chiang Kai-shek regularly went there to sit down, read his Bible. Now, every day he went there to have his quiet time. See? So you think back, you see, they are not perfect men. Whatever ideology you support, whether Mao or Chiang Kai-shek, the point is that for Sun Yat-sen to come about with these thoughts and then to have that ability to have foresight and to organize things, you must understand that the Bible had tremendous influence upon this man. Yeah? This mustn't be overlooked. Yeah? Then in the martial arts world, Huo Yangjia was a towering figure. You know, many people don't know about him until recent days when film shows were shown about him. But in the wushu world, you see, really, in recent history, there have been many great heroes in the past. But Huo Yangjia is really the modern hero that's towering, which many people up to now still don't appreciate. When you see it in the light of the history of that time, you begin to see why he's not just very good to be admired because of his kung fu skill. See, he fought against the Russian, he fought against the Japanese, he won so many matches, he restored the Marua, the face of the Chinese. See, but it's not just because of his martial arts skill. He was thinking of China and Chinese culture and how the Chinese people keep their arts to each family, and you keep it so secret that you wouldn't pass it on to a person with a different family name. Then you have, for example, Yang Jia Tai Chi Xian, the Tai Chi of the Yang family. Where did he get it from? From the Chen Jia, the Tan family kept the secret to themselves so much. And this person from the Yang Jia has to go there and work and sweep the floor and then churi-churi observe them and quietly practice, you see, until he was found out. And finally, the Chen people decided, Chen means Tan, Chen or Tan family, they decided to adopt him and teach him. And he turned out to be really very good, see. Then he was in Beijing and the emperor asked him to teach the son, so he had to modify it because he didn't want the fighting art to be passed on to these Manchurians whom they wanted to overthrow. See? But when ordered by the emperor, what do you do? See? So he modified the moves and so on. But the true secret of fighting was all kept to himself and passed down the Yang family. See? So that sort of history, China has a long history of that. Each family kept the art to himself. And then when it's not fully passed on, the art slowly dies. It dies off. So you see, the store of knowledge and the many potential good people, great people, you see, all the combination of the amount of knowledge they have, the skill and the knowledge they have, all begin to become rotten, you see, because we have this attitude, keep to ourselves. We are always rivaling one another. But when we come to Huo Yangjia, you see, a man with deep insight, although he was good at his martial arts skill, he had exposure. See, and he has eyes to see, intelligence to see that we can't go on like this. See? And at that time, remember, Sun Yat-sen was agitating for change and so on. So this man was also responding, and he was knowing that yes, change is needed. So what is my contribution? See? So on his part, he began to gather the real, true, recognized experts together, talk to them, and constant persevering. And many people are so used to the old ways, they don't want to share. But Huo Yangjia is saying, we have to share. We can't keep to ourselves, you see. Then along the way, they agreed, and they come to form the Jingwu. But Jingwu called what? Jingwu Wushu Guan. You say, martial arts school, finish. The government will be unhappy, you know, you're organizing arms to overthrow the government or what. It's sensitive to call yourself martial arts association or what. So they call it Jingwu Ti Yi Guan, for health or athletics association. You see, there's the way to go around it. You see, all these thoughts have to go in, they have to discuss and plan and without compromise and keep to their plan and yet have to adjust to the need of the situation. And when this it was first started in Shanghai, then they went to start in various major cities. So in Xiamen, they started one, and then in Guangzhou, they started one. Then they decided to move inland as well, and then they sent also people. Two brothers were sent to Singapore to start, and then from there, they came up to JB. They also established a Jingwu there. Then in Malacca, then in this Kuala Lumpur, then in Ipoh, then in Penang, up to today, you see this chain of Jingwu Ti Yi Guan, they're still there. Only thing is, the attention of those who like martial arts has been channeled to various other branches such as Wing Chun and then recently Tai Chi. But Jing Wu Ti Kwan is still there. That is a history. And this has spread to America, Canada. You Google tonight, Jing Wu at Athletic Association. See where in the world they are. Or in Germany, everywhere. You say, now, it's a little bit eclipsed by other styles now, especially the Chen Jia Tai Chi Chen, the Chen Jia practical method, Su Yong Tai Chi Chen, was propagated by this Chinese man who settled in Canada. So, and also others, the Westerners, there are two or three very, very good Tai Chi experts. So Tai Chi seems to occupy the attention of many at this time. So before that was Wing Chun. Before that it was this Jeet Kune Do and so on by Bruce Lee. And so on. See? But the point is that before that, 1900s, 1910, Jing Wu Ti Yi Kwan was established. See? And you must understand that the martial thinking was very much part of Chinese culture until modern days, until these recent days. With the founding of modern China, you see, now about that time, the emphasis is now more on the pursuit of knowledge, scientific knowledge, and building up the economy of the country. These two things occupy the mind of the Chinese now, see. But in the background, the wushu spirit is still in them. That's why whenever they see any kung fu show, or it excites them. That's why when you read about the Wu Ling and Jiang Hu and all this, you see, it excites the people who understand a little bit of this background. See, in my younger days, you see, there was this man who cycled selling cloth, you see. Now my parents say, this is Zhao Gang Oi Lang, you know, Zhou Jiang Hu, he's a martial arts world type of person. He travels around but selling cloth, but actually he belongs to that category of people. So with this in the background, you must understand at that time how it intersects with the Christian faith is that the missionaries were going there to preach for a long time. They encountered difficulties at first, then many were converted. See, and when China was very upset with the opium being spread around and the people becoming weak, and then nationalism begin to grip them. So what do they do? The martial arts people come up. That is why the Boxer Rebellion. Boxer is not boxing, you know. Boxer is wushu. Kung Fu people, they have to take the lead. They have to rely on them. And I tell you, even in our the Southeast Asia, see, when we were younger, you see, there's the government army and police, but there is also the underground army, you see. Whenever there's problem that can't be solved, who come up? It's the gangsters, all these come with the parangs and so on. And all this, they were organized in the way the people were organizing the rebellion to overthrow the Manchus. So the triads, different secret society, it's all organized along that line. This began that time, you see, because in each province there was a flag, you know, a banner, that means a regiment of underground people ready to overthrow when the signal is given, overthrow the Manchus. See, so the style, the way of organizing themselves has been passed down, and the secret societies are around everywhere today. See, but originally the purpose was to overthrow the Manchus. See, so when the Christian faith spread, the Chinese who were so upset with the Western people who spread opium and suck out all the economy, you see, they can't distinguish between Christians who were doing them so much good and the majority white men who were just sucking away their economy and weakening them. So when the wushu people came up, they killed the Christians also. So the Christians, missionaries, many died, and the local Christians was claimed to be the supporters of these Westerners. They also died. So that lies in the background. Then in Korea at that time also, revival took place now about that time, 1910 period. And what happened is missionaries have been preaching there for a long while, and then God's spirit began to move. And then many were converted. Many confessed their sins. Nobody asked them to confess, but in their hearts, they just cannot stand it anymore. They were so guilty before God, they confessed. It's in front of everyone. They told about their adultery, their stealing, their killing, whatever. You know, it all came out. The missionaries themselves tremble. You know, if we can help it, we don't want to hear this type of thing. But God's Spirit moved them. See, and the revival spread. People were converted. See, and all this was in preparation for the war, because many died in the war. Japan attacked. See, and then after that they attacked Manchuria. See? Then because of the fighting and the Western powers got involved, and then Korea was divided into North and South. See, and today the Christian faith has thrived in the South, but in the North it's still there, but suppressed, greatly suppressed. See, so this we have to know. Then in India, this Mahatma Gandhi, he graduated from Britain, a lawyer, then he agitated for liberty and freedom, the rights of the marginalized. And in South Africa, there were many Indians. So he went there at first, settled there, worked there, and then he organized civil strike, and so on to defend the rights of the oppressed people. Then after that, he went back to India, and he saw how the situation is no different, even worse. He organized this non-violence, civil disobedience. He wouldn't fight with force. He just tell the people, we just disagree. Just sit down, don't do anything. So what can they do to us? So the bus all strike. So up to today, you go to places like Nepal, you say, this is their approach. They know if they use force, they would lose, because the army has the guns. But their approach is to call for nationwide strike. Nobody should be on the road, so no buses, no taxi, nothing. See, so make the government surrender and say, yeah, okay, please, you know, to stop the strike, then we will discuss this matter. See, so Gandhi was very good at organizing this. But remember, Gandhi had the country had tremendous influence, been tremendously influenced by William Carey and his friends. See? And of course, many people don't realize this. But really, some years back, a stamp was published in India to commemorate William Carey's arrival there, 200 years after his arrival in 1993. Okay. And I have a copy of the stamp. Because a missionary from there, I wrote to ask this lady missionary, so can you send me a copy of... And she bought a stamp, a fresh new one, just to send to me. And the reason was because at that time I wanted to illustrate Gospel Highway. So we used that stamp to illustrate the story of William Carey. Now, William Carey, he went there with great difficulty, and he's really a genius in his own way. You see, he wasn't educated. He didn't have the chance for higher education. See? But he was a very intelligent man. So he self-studied. He learned about the world, he drew a rough map and put down the population and the religions of the people. And as the traders came back, remember the British Empire was expanding. Yeah, so as the traders came back, he got information from them and then jotted down. And so he had an idea of how big the world is, what the population is like, what religions are where. And his heart grew so burdened, the gospel must be brought to the heathens. So he persuaded his friends. And finally, they formed that missionary society that sent him to India. And in India, you see, his intelligence began to show. See, he studied the Indian language so well by studying their literature, the Sanskrit and their literature. You see, each culture has its own pool of literature. And you see, if you say Chinese culture, there would be the books of Confucius and those classics, you see, that you must study. But in India, they have their own literature in Sanskrit, which William Carey studied well and translated into English. And in that way, he gained a good grasp of the language, and then he began to translate the Bible, created a dictionary, and you know the story, it was burned down, years of hard work burned down. So he had to start from scratch. But this time he produced a better one, you see, and faster, because he has done one which was burned down. Okay? But you can imagine hati sakit, the pain in his heart when all his years of hard work was burned down. But he said, I'm a plotter, I can plot. So he continued, persevere. And he, in the end, he translated the Bible into 32 languages. And remember, India is a subcontinent. It's almost a full continent. See? So it's not just one people. It's many people there with different languages. Yeah? So remember, Tamil is in, that we are used to here in Malaysia. They all come from South India. But the central and northern parts, there are different languages. Gujarati is different, Bengali is different, Hindi is different. Yeah. So different languages. But William Carey, from one language, he mastered another one related to it, mastered another one related to it. In that way, he mastered many languages and he translated the Bible in 32 languages. And he was a botanist. He was interested in botany. So he studied the plants, collected samples, he corresponded with the highly qualified botanists in UK, and then they were very interested in what he was saying and the exchange. And botany of India was made famous by all this, by William Carey's effort to preserve the plants from getting extinct and things like that, you see. Then he studied anthropology, you see. Then he also saw that the situation, the social situation, not right, not good. So for the gospel's sake and for the good of the country, for the people, he started colleges, teach the people. And these people who later learned good English, they were part of the backbone of the government. When the British left, you see, they were there, ready to serve. See, the influence. And then remember, Carey's translation of literature resulted in interest in their own literature, so that people began to study their own literature. Wow, nationalism unwittingly was revived because of the influence of William Carey. There were other factors, no doubt, but the point is, don't miss out on William Carey's contribution to the revival of nationalism in India. So he agitated for the practice of burning widow, the practice called sati. When the husband died, the body is burned, so the wife has to tie it up and then put there on top and burn together with the husband. So he stopped that, you see. And you know the story, it was a Sunday, he was supposed to preach in a church. But the news came, the law has been passed, you know, to stop sati. So William Carey told his friend, you preach today, you see, I have to translate this. Because in every hour, how many thousands of widows are being burned to death? So even 1 minute matters, you see. So he translated there and then while his friend preached, you see. So and then send it out to tell people, the law has been passed, so read it out to the people. So to stop the practice of sati, see, and how many thousands of souls were saved, and perhaps some of the descendants are here today, see, because the wives were not burned with their husband, see. So William Carey's contribution should be noted. Then in the West, the World War I started with the Austrian Duke there being killed, and then the whole of Europe take sides, and then with the result that 16 million people died, you know? And at the same time, remember at that time was people, because of the Enlightenment followed by scientific discoveries, and ships were sailing overseas and doing trading, and then of course the crooked people began to take advantage of the natives and bringing back a lot of things, you know? And so, but the missionaries took the opportunity. Trading ships means there's transport to go overseas. The information that William Carey gleaned from all these traders. So by the 1900, missionaries were still going out. By that time, they cooperated, and despite the war, many went out to preach the gospel elsewhere. Then after the war, after 16 million people died, they formed the League of Nations to try and prevent the war, but still it didn't succeed to prevent the war. Not long after that, the Second World War broke out, 1939 to 1945. And because by that time, the Western influence over the East is there, the war in the West would affect the East. And that's why when Japan takes sides with the German, you discover the Second World War affected this part of the world very badly as well. See? And then it has been, people have said that just in China alone, how many died compared to the whole of the world elsewhere. But people don't recognize this. The research still has to be done, and the record has to be put straight. See, the war affected this part very badly. It's not just the West. People just focus on the figures in the West. But in China, one country alone, the number who died is just equal to or even more than all that have died in the West. So up to now, this has not been corrected. So somebody really has to do studies in this. But the point of the matter is that in such an atmosphere, see, things were changing, affecting the church and the Christian faith. Remember that the people in America were mostly from Europe, mostly. So they went there, they brought the Christian faith there as well. So traders went there, colonists went there, colonized the place, see? But the Christians went there to preach the gospel. And just like in the East, people can't tell the difference between the Christians and the traders. They would regard them as the same. When in fact the Christians never approve of corruption, never approve of oppressing the natives. And many of the Christian missionaries, in fact, were a great help to the natives. See? So those who know, they would acknowledge that. But in general, people say, you know, the missionaries went there to control the mind of the people. Then the colonists go there, use the gun to control them. See, so one control the mind, one control the body. See, that's their claim. But they don't realize that missionaries never approve of the ways of the unconverted people. So often, missionaries themselves face problems from their own people. For example, when William Carey arrived in Calcutta, the British there wanted to stop him and wanted to drive him home, wanted to send him home. So he had to run to the Danish concession. So remember, they have different concessions just in China. Each country carve up for themselves an area called a concession. So Carey has to run to the Danish concession and be protected by them. See, otherwise he would have been sent home already. So Carey has to work very hard until finally he was allowed to go into the British area. Yeah. So missionaries really had a hard time not only having to do missionary work, but also from their own countrymen who were not believers at all. They were there to take advantage of the people. Then what happened is that Darwinism has spread, evolution theory has spread. So it affected people like Hitler, who wants to produce a super race. Oh, they must be tall, blonde hair, blue eyes people. This is the Aryan race. See, so he began to kill off the Jews. See? So millions of Jews died. See? Those who are anti-Jews who try to deny it or try to put a figure lower, you know, and it's not right. You see, millions of people die. You don't want people to minimize the number of Chinese who died. See, fact is fact, and especially when their family members affected. So it's not right to say to be anti-Jewish. Though many died because of Darwinism being absorbed into socialist theory, so they began to want to cull away, you know, put to death those weaker strain of the human race, want to produce a super race. That's how it happened. Yeah? Then, you see, Darwinism influenced the study of the Bible, and Spurgeon was very concerned. Spurgeon preached out against it and warned people, you know, but the people were not listening to him. See? So finally, Spurgeon has to withdraw his church from the Baptist Union because outwardly they were listening, but when it came to the crunch, they were not going to put into practice what he was advocating, that we must return to the Bible, we must stop liberalism from influencing us, but they wouldn't listen. So what happened is, because of the exchanges between America and Europe, so liberalism also went there, see. So in America, the evangelicals at that time grouped together to counter liberalism. They say, we can't just do nothing about this. Something has to be done. So they ignore the differences, slight differences between them at that time. There were those who were fundamentalists, those who had different views of the millennial and so on. So they came together. Those were the old evangelicals. They all believed in the authority of the Bible. They believed that the gospel of justification by faith. See, they grouped together to counter liberalism. Liberalism, as we have mentioned already, tried to study the Bible by the so-called scientific method. And along the way, they questioned the authenticity of many parts of the Bible, so shaking the faith of many. Then they also questioned the miraculous elements in the Bible. No resurrection of the dead, no virgin birth of Christ. Say, miracles were just stories only. There's no such thing as miracles to them. There's no creation in 6 days. See? So liberalism was affecting the faith of many. So the evangelicals gathered together. So they assign each topic to an expert. So you are an expert in New Testament. So can you please write a book to show that really Christ was born at that time, that there was the virgin birth, there was resurrection. See? So then if you are Old Testament expert, then you are expert in another area, interpretation of the Bible and Christian history and various areas. So a number of such books were produced, called the Fundamentals. So these Fundamentals were published, millions of copies were published, and one rich Christian man sponsored the publishing of these books. And they sent to all the pastors they knew, and they sent to all the seminary students. See? And in that way, liberalism was countered. It didn't disappear, it was still there, but at least the advance was slowed down. See? And that is called the fundamentalist liberal controversy at that time. And it can also be called the evangelical liberal clash, the clash at that time. See? And what happened is that after liberalism has been stopped, remember it still didn't disappear. Some people were still liberal. They are still found in the universities in many parts of the world, the liberal theological faculties. You study theology in a university, most likely it is going to be liberal. So to study the Bible in a more the evangelical way, we have to go to colleges and these seminaries. See? That generally is the truth. Yeah. University of Amsterdam used to be a well-known Christian university, see, but it also became liberal. See? So that's the situation. So what happened is after the evangelical-liberal clash in 1930s, see, then when things are more comfortable already, see, the liberals and atheists in America began to challenge the evangelicals. They seem to be so influential, you see. So there is a so-called Scopy case, you see. They took the Christian men to court for advocating Christian principles in the school. So they went to court, they argue it out. But this man, because he's not well trained in this area, so his argument in court was not so good. He should have get the experts in. So the newspaper go and jeer and spread, twist things around and make the Christians appear so shameful. Say, you really are backward people who are not scientific and who are, you know, arguing your case because you are dogmatic and legalistic. See? So the press keep splashing around the idea that evangelicals were backward, ignorant people who were unreasonable. So battles were having to be fought. And attention was focused on the news all the time over this case, you see. And because there's no real battle fought now, it's just a case of being attacked, you're on the defensive, on the legal front, you see. So with time, the evangelical party split, you see. Then there was the fundamentalists, then the reformed people, then the neo-evangelicals. So in the past, they were together known as the evangelicals, or sometimes called the old evangelicals. Okay. But when they split, it becomes obvious, the fundamentalists, they were always saying separation. Use only the old King James Bible. You must believe in the premillennial, the return of Jesus Christ, the secret rapture. So these are distinctives of the distinctive teaching of the fundamentalists. There might be slight differences between them, but that's basically the teaching. Then of course the Reform would be what we know already, holding the Calvinistic view of salvation, the five solas of the Reformation, sola scriptura, scripture alone is our authority, by faith alone, by grace alone, see. So to God's glory alone, see? Then the regulative principle of worship, see? So the Reformed faith. Then the neo-evangelicals, they were not fundamentalists, not Reformed, they believe that the gospel, Christ crucified, but they are more open, see. And at that time, because they have been fighting battles, fighting, see, somebody claimed that, you know, wow, he has the gifts of the Spirit, see. And Edward Irving in Scotland went to London, and then he's spreading around, oh, the prophecy of the Bible is being restored. So there are prophets. So in America, he has gone there already, and then suddenly the Pentecostal movement became prominent. So their claim is that the rest are all dead orthodoxy, doctrine correct, but no life. So they are more lively. So the Pentecostal movement came out. So there are four groups now, basically. So from there comes the realignment, the evangelical realignment. As they spread, you see, each influence one another. Some become fundamentalists, see, who were formerly Reformed. Others who were fundamentalists, they become closer to the Reformed position. Some Reformed people were influenced by the Pentecostals. Yeah. And in 1960, yeah, there was a renewal of interest, a revival of interest in Reformed theology after that time. See, 1930s, when the split occurs, then all the various groups spread their own belief. See, so two groups were spreading strongly. One was the Pentecostal. They were everywhere throughout the world. And then in 1960s, their teaching spread to other denominations. So it became known as the Charismatic Movement. So Pentecostalism becomes absorbed into the overall movement called the Charismatic Movement, where other denominations are affected as well. See? But Reformed teaching has been quietly spreading. See? And now it's affecting other denominations. Many Charismatics, they know that they are weak in theology, so they begin to absorb Reformed teaching, but not the whole of Reformed teaching. So a man like Wayne Grudem came up with systematic theology, trying to fuse Reformed teaching with Charismatic teaching. So many neo-evangelicals would jump on that and say, wow, this is very good systematic theology. So they claim that they are Reformed, when actually they are not. They only hold to the 5 points of Calvinism, but they don't hold to the five solas of the Reformation. They don't believe in the regulative principle of worship. Instead, they advocate contemporary worship, hand clapping, hallelujah, you see? The different instruments, drum set being used in worship. Then they believe in tongue speaking, healing, and so on. You see? So basically, they're from charismatic background and borrow some the doctrine of from the Reformed people, and they want to call themselves Reformed. So these are the new Calvinists. So we have this crossing over here and there. John Stott, Anglican Reformed man, see? So he became neo-evangelical. See? He joined force with Billy Graham to start the Lausanne Conference for World Evangelism. See? Then he began to propagate the idea of annihilism. That means a soul dies in hell and then it dies until finally it disappears. See? That's annihilated. So people become upset. You know, he used to be a respected writer, but he now become neo-evangelical and began to teach annihilationism. But many people who follow him still don't know. See, but or rather they pretend that is not important. But you see, this is part of the evangelical realignment. When we are not careful, we are influenced that way. We are not careful, we are influenced this way. So see, and people try to merit Reform and Charismatic teaching, see? But they are contradictory. So this is what we are getting now. What we must see is rather that the Charismatic people are being influenced by Reformed people, but they have not been influenced far enough. See? Some Reformed people, they are softening, they are being influenced by the Charismatic people. See? So the process continues up to now. Now we consider Reformed theology and missions. As we enter the postmodern age in 21st century, new issues confront us. So we mentioned relativism, individualism, and youthful zeal is glorified, pluralism. That means we must include everyone, not just one race, and every race must be represented, and so on. So there's such emphasis on this to the point that it sounds a bit artificial. We can't help feeling that people want to portray themselves as so righteous. You see? So while injustices should be corrected, we admit gender inequality should be abolished, we must really practice the Bible's teaching. You see? There's no more Jew and Greek, Jew and Gentile. There's no more male and female. Each have our role to play, but we don't go to the extent of the modernists. Some of them really have become ultra gender sensitive. See, so in such an atmosphere, we have to note that in the 1960s, the revival of Reformed teaching means that now we are ready. People want to listen to us. Reformed faith. Before they would not listen, but now they are prepared to listen. They find a certain respectability. But when it comes to missions, what have we to offer? Currently, we have nothing to offer. See, in Reformed Baptist seminaries, which book of missions would we recommend? It's just like some years back on church government. Which book on church government? What teaching do we have on the Reformed Baptist view of church government? Often we would say, oh, we are independent churches. We believe in only believers only get baptized. Is that all that your ecclesiology, your doctrine of the church? Then our eldership, the doctrine, the theory behind the eldership and behind the church, we borrow from the Presbyterians. We take their literature. We borrow, quote from their books here and there. Mm-hmm. To support ourselves until such a stage, then we begin to teach our distinctives. Okay, certain things are common to all Christians. It's not wrong, but my point is that up to that point, there was no definitive teaching that we look at ecclesiology as a whole from the Reformed Baptist perspective. See? And similarly, I'm observing that now, as far as missiology, the study of missions is concerned, we have nothing to offer. Really nothing. See? We're not saying that Reformed people has not been active in missions. They have always been active in missions. But to have time to think and put things together and see from an overall perspective, this is what we believe to be the biblical teaching, consistent with our Reformed characteristics. See, it has not been produced yet. Okay. So we feel saddened by the situation. Everyone must contribute their part who are able. And here is our little attempt to try and contribute something, to say, see it from this perspective, the overall perspective, this is how we must approach missions. So a proposed model to study missions, therefore, is given like this. First, we must note Reformed theology believes in, holds to the doctrine of the covenant. So covenant theology is very much Reformed. If you don't know or do not believe in covenant theology, you cannot call yourself Reformed. Whether a Reformed Baptist, Reformed Presbyterian, or Reformed whatever. See? So that is why the new Calvinists, they are hardly Reformed. They only hold to the 5 points of Calvinism. You don't hear of the 5 solas of the Reformation in their midst. You don't hear even any talk about why the Reformation is important. See? And you see the style of worship, you know, you talk about regulative principle and the confessions of faith that came from the Reformation, they will keep clear, because if they open it up, their people will be questioning, hey, the Reformation, they believe so many things correct, and how come here they disagree with us? We are not in agreement with them. See, you will open their eyes. See? So they keep quiet about the Reformation, they keep quiet about the confessions of faith. See? And they know their own weakness, they are weak in doctrine. All the while they are so subjective. So now they borrow the 5 points of Calvinism from the Reformed people and say, we believe in sovereignty of God. We believe in God choosing his people for salvation. And of course, through the shallow understanding of the charismatic people. This is new teaching. Wow, they are very interested in that. And so they gather for conferences, Gospel Coalition and various other conferences like that. They'll come together. And here in Malaysia, they're calling these people together. They say, oh, we are reformed. They say, reformed? When you study more carefully, look at them more carefully, you discover it's only the 5 points of Calvinism. Look at the way of life. See, not much change. Still very worldly, young, brash, you know, daring to do anything. Oh, that type of attitude. They cultivate that type of worldly attitude. See. So they only have 5 points of Calvinism to excite them intellectually, but they don't emphasize on sanctification and in their worship, you see. They have pop bands and modern songs and hand clapping. They believe in tongue speaking, healing. So to us, that is new Calvinism. That is not Reformed teaching. So for us, we say covenant theology is important. So we are saying that missions is rooted in the eternal purpose of God, because covenant theology shows to us, see, the plan of God. God from eternity in the past already planned for the salvation of his people, and it will end in eternity when all the elect will be gathered there. Okay? So, God willing, in the next study, we will look at some of the main points of covenant theology. So, to therefore talk about missions, you must see it in the light of God's plan of salvation, and you must see that it is rooted there. See? And the concept of the root, the concept of the tree, you see, is in the Bible. So in Romans 11, verse 16 to 18, we are told, see, that the root is holy. So branches then are cut off, and then the wild olive branch is grafted in, and God will graft back some natural branches. That means those who are physical descendants of Abraham, those who are physically Jews, there will be some of them who are chosen by God who will be saved. See? But the root, what is the root? Study more carefully, you discover the root is God's eternal plan of salvation. See? Okay? And secondly, we know that Jesus Christ is the vine, we are the branches. That means the branches are attached to the vine. But at other times, it's the tree that is used. We are the branches. The church will grow. Christ tells us that we must abide in him in order to be fruitful. See? So where are the fruits growing from? From the branches. So the branches must abide in the trunk. Okay? Then the tree will grow big, and then the birds of the air will build nests there. That means the tree will become a place of shelter for the bruised and the broken in the world. There were those who need to be protected, who need direction in life. They will come under the sound of the gospel. So the church is like the crown of the tree supported by the trunk. So the trunk, where is it planted? It's firmly planted, rooted in the ground. So missions has to begin with the root, then it comes to the trunk. The trunk is Jesus Christ, who died and make atonement for the sins of his people. Without Christ coming to die to make atonement for his people, there's no missions. What message do you preach? And those who go out to preach must have faith in Christ, otherwise how can you preach the gospel? So that's why I say it is the trunk is grounded, firmly grounded. Then we come to the crown, see, the crown where the birds build nests, and then we are to be fruitful. So that gives the idea of the crown of the tree. So the tree has these three major parts: the root, the trunk that is grounded in, then the crown involving the leaves, the branches, the fruits. Okay. So when we study missions, we must bear in mind that this is the background of it. If you talk about missions on the practical level, or what, how do we bring the gospel to the natives? What should we do about language studies? And what about their idols? What do we do? You're only touching here, touching there. Yeah. So that would not form a satisfactory missiology. It's just a how-to book. How to do this, how to do that. See? So patchwork approach in missions is not satisfactory at all. Say, similarly, patchwork approach to church life and to the Christian life, we should begin from the Bible. We begin with doctrine. Theology should be at the base of our thinking. So when you get the theology right, then you see how it applies. Then it is more wholesome. And so the proposal is that we must see missions, which is the fulfillment of the Great Commission, as rooted in the eternal purpose of God. It is grounded in the atoning death of Christ, and it is crowned by the Great Commission. So the Great Commission is like the crown. We see the beautiful tree by seeing the crown first. You don't admire a tree from the root or from the trunk. The root you can see. You don't just look at the trunk. Generally, from a distance, you look at a tree, the first thing that catches your eye is the crown. See? So the crown is also like the crown on the princess head or so. It makes the head, the person look beautiful. So the crown provides what is visible and beautiful first. Then when we look carefully, we say, there's the trunk. Then we know that the trunk is firmly grounded with the roots deep inside. So to provide a satisfactory missiology, we must see that it's like that. Rooted in the eternal purpose of God, grounded in the death and resurrection of Christ, and crowned with a great commission. Then you see the diagram of the approach so that you know the terms used. At the top there, we have God's eternal purpose, leading to it being revealed in the Old Testament, fulfilled in the New Testament, and gathered in eternity future, as described to us in the book of Revelation. So that four squares at the top constitute the outline of covenant theology, which shows to us God's eternal purpose. Then its fulfillment in the New Testament requires the carrying out of the Great Commission. The elect has to be called out. That's why the Great Commission is given. So the fulfillment of the Great Commission constitutes missions. So what is mission? Oh, to convert the heathen. But that's not a satisfactory answer. See, it's more than that. So missions is the fulfillment of the Great Commission. To fulfill the Great Commission, there is a methodology that is inbuilt in the Great Commission. Don't look for the methodology elsewhere. God, the Lord, has given us this commission. So how is to be carried out? It's in there. So the methodology consists of principles and methods. Okay? The principles and methods, the principles we must grasp and apply. So the methods, we try and see how the principles are applied. Then it becomes the method in the New Testament. The methods can be followed as far as possible, but in certain situations, they might have to be adapted. But if we understand the principles, we will learn how to adapt correctly. See? So we don't just simply contextualize without understanding the principles. So therefore, we have to study the principles and methods in the Bible and follow the principles all the time and adopt the methods when it is possible. Otherwise, adapt the principles to the methods necessary for our situation. Then after that, we come down to the sub-objectives. See, the final objective is right at the bottom, the planting of churches. We have to prove that first. So the Great Commission is a command to the local church to plant local churches. So that is the ultimate objective. But there are sub-objectives along the way. So there is going into the world to make disciples. So that constitutes evangelism. And many people focus only on this one part and think that that is missions. So I'm saying, no, you haven't fully understood the Great Commission. The Great Commission is not just making disciples. We are told then baptize them in the name of the Father and of the Son of the Holy Spirit. But what does baptism mean? It doesn't mean just baptize, but baptize to show that you have faith, but baptize to be a member of the church also. So what is the church like? Who constitute the membership? So that second sub-objective involves more than just the act of baptism. So if you think carefully, the person has become a disciple. I don't just boom, finish baptism, finish. No. He's baptized in order to be part of the church. But what is the church? How do you form a church? Who constitute the membership? This has to be discussed. So this is the second sub-objective. Then the third sub-objective is teach them to observe all the Lord's commands. See? Now that involves building them up in the faith. That also involves training them so that they become the next generation of teachers, the next generation of preachers. See? So in that way, missions go on. The Great Commission is carried on until Jesus Christ returns to judge the world. So you see now how short-sighted and how narrow our view of missions has been. We have looked at the, from the bottom up is the second row from the bottom. And we have looked at only the first sub-objective. Make disciples. Evangelism. To us, that is missions. So to have a proper missiology, the study of missions, we have to have a more satisfactory approach. So this would be the approach that is being proposed. Okay, so with that, we come to the end of tonight's study. And God willing, in the future studies, we will be able to understand better each part and then stand back and look at the whole again.